We'll be having lunch in just a few moments out in the grove, just as we ate yesterday, the same tent, same bat channel. We'll be having duck hash from Yachna River Inn, which is a local restaurant. It's about 8 miles out in the country here. The chef is Paige Osborne. Paige will be there, and you'll get a chance to talk with Paige. They do wonderful food, and if any of you are staying over Sunday night tonight, it's a great destination restaurant to drive out. About 8 miles out in the country, bring your own wine. You can't buy wine on Sunday. If you need a bottle, let me know. I'll give you one of mine. yeah, there's a stash. Nonetheless, I hope you enjoy lunch, and I thank you all for being here this weekend. Our final speaker, I think we may have saved one of the best, if not the best, for last, and that's Bill Rice's talk. We've been talking all weekend about Southern migration. We've been talking about the Southern influence upon the whole of the nation, the nation's foodways. And Bill has agreed enthusiastically to talk about Craig Claiborne as a Southerner and his influence as the editor of the New York Times food page. Bill himself is the Chicago Tribune's food and wine columnist. He's been a reporter for almost 30 years. He has a degree with honors from the Cordon Bleu in Paris. And from 1980 through 1985, he was the editor-in-chief of Food and Wine magazine. He has a BA in history from the University of Virginia and graduated with honors from the Graduate School of Journalism at Columbia University in New York City. Since 1994, Bill has been the chairman of the Restaurant Awards Committee for the James Beard Foundation. It's my honor, my pleasure to welcome Bill Rice.
Oh, we could have saved some time right there, but I do want to make a confession before I get into this. I did not grow up in a wine culture, but I've been doing my best to make up for it ever since. I know there are a number of you here who know Craig and or his legend probably better than I do, but I'm sort of caught between a rock and a hot place here because the food's out there and I know you're going to start smelling it.
Bill, take all the time you want. We're fine. I'm serious.
Nah, you don't mean that. The first time I met Craig was back in 1969, not long after two awful things had happened, the riots that swept through America and Richard Nixon's election. Mutual friends had suggested that we might meet and talk because I was at sort of a crossroads in my career. So a luncheon was arranged in New York and went to a small restaurant and met Craig and we talked about my problems and my future. He was most solicitous for most of the meal. And I didn't know what I said, but all of a sudden he just cut off and wasn't paying much attention to me and monosyllabic answers to questions. And finally, he looks at me and he says, "I can't stand this, but I forgot my wallet. You're going to have to pay for lunch." out of that came an on-again, off-again acquaintanceship. Very difficult to be a close friend of Craig's, at least for very long. He encouraged me, and of course I realized it was because it was sort of a parallel of his own life, to go to France and spend time at the Cordon Bleu, which I did. So why had I sought him out? Because in those days he was God. It may be consoling to know that the particular God at the age of 35 was between jobs with no real work prospect. But boy, when he landed, it was a simpler time, and New York was a simpler town. But Craig had power, and it was tangible. A restaurant critic, he had developed the four-star system, now widely imitated. At the Times, restaurateurs quivered at the thought of his arrival. He, He wrote books, very successful books. In fact, the New York Times cookbook, his very first book, still in print, eventually cleared $1 million, and Craig had all the royalties on that book. The Times gave it to him because they thought it didn't mean anything. Big mistake. But he eventually wrote more than 20 books. But in addition to that, a feature in his Wednesday column in the Times landed more than a few people book contracts, just out of the piece he'd written about people. So if he helped New York discover where to dine, he also taught the stay-at-homes how to cook for company, introduced cooks to dishes from around the world. And in that sense, he was the right person in the right place at the right time. People trusted, believed in the Times. For the first time, Craig himself was part of the establishment, and he liked that very much. The Times, in turn, was eager to be a paper of record, to cover the entire world. So Craig had a budget to dine out and travel. And he wasn't alone at that point in food. Julia was known as Julia. Jim was known as Jim around the country. Travel Holiday magazine did a rather elaborate series of restaurant awards. But no single journalist so dominated before or since. He was, after all, the first male newspaper food editor, the first avowed sensualist food editor. He wrote about the pleasures of cooking and dining, using vivid adjectives to woo his audience instead of reminders of the seven basic food groups. He was comfortable in the male-dominated world of chefs, including French chefs, and drew good stories from them. Previously, food editors had been reasonably passive, dependent on food companies and public relations agencies for much of their material. These editors also, as Gene Bolts well knows, were overworked, taken advantage of, and didn't have the budget to follow through on stories they did want to cover. But since we're in Mississippi, and Craig was born here, let's go back to his youth. Mississippi provided Craig with a taste of the broad spectrum of foods from up and down the food chain. It also helped him win his job, and it was an apt setting for scenes from a Southern Gothic life lived on an emotional roller coaster. The title of his 1982 autobiography, A Feast Made for Laughter, could easily have been A Feast Made for Tears. At best, the laughter was wistful. A sketch of the early years. Born in 1920, the youngest of three children. Father loses everything when Craig is four. Mother, strong, talented, and domineering, opens a boarding house. There's a curious parallel here to James Beard's life. Typical exchange between mother and son. On learning Craig placed second in a spelling bee, she said, "You should be ashamed." At 35, Craig had yet another wrenching argument with his mother and pulled the plug. He never saw her again. You don't have to be Jewish. The father fades into the background, except for a sexual incident with his son. Did it have any effect? Craig, who wrote, "I was not a robust child, and I had an extremely delicate nature," dedicates his feast to, quote, "my father, who valued honesty above all and encouraged me to tell the truth." There's also thanks to the encouragement offered by another Mississippian, Willie Morris. But little surprise that Craig eventually develops a weakness for drink, comes to know and visit a series of psychoanalysts. But an interlude on the brighter side of the South from Craig Claiborne's Southern cooking. "Nothing rekindles my spirit, gives comfort to my heart and mind, more than a visit to Mississippi and in Byron's. To sit down to a dinner, the meal any Southerner knows, taken at midday, and be regaled, as often as I have been, with a platter of fried chicken, field peas, collard greens, fresh corn on the cob, sliced tomatoes with French dressing, that's what we call vinaigrette sauce, and to top it all off with a wedge of freshly baked pecan pie, with vanilla ice cream or without, the beverage for that meal being, more likely than not, sweetened iced tea. And each time I lift my fork, 1,000 recollections of things past filter through my mind. I recall with fond memories the outings the family made in those years with my neighbors and friends to Four Mile Lake, a watering spot near my small hometown. Gliding about in the water were small pleasure craft, many of whose passengers dangled fishing lines from cane poles, hoping a catfish would nibble. In the crystal clear waters, the lines could be seen all the way to the bottom. Many of the men wore linen suits and black string ties, and some wore white straw hats or boaters with wide brims. Some of the women carried parasols to guard their skin against that burning Mississippi sun. Once a sufficient batch of catfish had been hauled aboard the various craft, they were carried ashore and cleaned with hunting knives. There were wide vats of hot oil near the shore and picnic tables not far away. The catfish would be dredged in a large tub of cornmeal and cooked in the hot fat until crisp without and succulent within. The catfish would be eaten with a bottled ketchup, a little Worcestershire sauce, a little Tabasco sauce, and lemon wedges, and sweetened iced tea. No wonder he was a romantic about food all his life. He continues, one of my favorite recollections of my mother's boarding house was her annual chitlin supper, which always occurred during hog killing time. The chitlins, or chitterlings if you prefer, were always served with vinegar and hot pepper flakes, plus turnip greens and lots of cornbread. Prior to that annual feast, she would give the boarders ample notice that it was about to happen, and if they didn't like it, they could simply dine elsewhere. When I was about 12 or 13 years old, I conceived my first original dish. For some reason unfathomable to me, I decided I would like to sample creamed chicken livers. And I mentioned this to Joe, the second in command of that boarding house kitchen. And prepare it he did, to my great delight. It consisted simply of sauteed chicken livers served in a light cream sauce, heavily spiked with black pepper. It is not a question of chauvinism, but I have always averred that Southern cooking is by far the vastest and most varied of all traditional regional cooking in this country. I do not wish to demean the other regions' cooking of the nation, but it is far more limited in scope. Southern cooking embraces soul food, which is a blend of primarily African and American Indian, Creole, which is a marriage of innocent Spanish and, to a degree, bastardized French, the Cajun, which is a creation of hardscrabble whites. They had to live in Louisiana on what they were able to forage from the land and rivers and sea, with French overtones. The cooking of the Southwest, with its strong Mexican overtones, a basic blend of cornmeal and hot chilies, and barbecue. That's that, which are found in one aspect or another in all southern states, using either vinegar and or ketchup as a primary ingredient for its basting sauce. Foods that are not cooked with a basting sauce are not, as is presumed in much of the North, barbecued. They are grilled, broiled, spit-roasted, and spit-turned. Complete volumes could and have been written about each of these elements of Southern cooking, Creole, Cajun, Tex-Mex, soul food, and barbecues. An encyclopedic, exhaustive study of all Southern dishes would, of necessity, demand a number of books sufficient to fill a library shelf and more. Someone pointed out yesterday the lack of recipes here so far, so I'll try to correct that just about now. Here are two recipes, one from the Old South and one from the New. Incidentally, the very first recipe in the Southern book is for cheese straws. Excuse me. Basic smothered chicken. One dish that was very much part of my Mississippi childhood was dubbed smothered chicken. I suppose it could be regarded as soul food. Basic, easy to prepare. In my books, it belongs to the comfort category, a food that gives solace to the spirit when you dine on it. And what that consisted of was simply a butterfly chicken, salt, pepper, butter, flour, chicken stock, or canned chicken broth. A black iron skillet is essential for the authentic preparation of this dish. You sprinkle the chicken on both sides with salt and pepper. Select a skillet large enough to hold the chicken. Fold the chicken wings under, hold them secure. Melt butter, add the chicken skin side down. Cover the chicken firmly with a plate. Add several weights, about 5 pounds in total. Cook over low heat until the skin of the chicken is nicely browned. Turn the chicken skin side up, replace the plate, and continue cooking. Remove the chicken and pour off all but 25 tablespoons of fat, two tablespoons of fat. Well, at least it wasn't garlic. Add the flour, et cetera, stir, chicken stock, stir, return the chicken to the skillet, season, continue cooking 30 minutes until the chicken is exceptionally tender. And that's that. Serve with fluffy rice. Then the ingredients to a more modern dish, succotash with hominy. 6 ears on short, shucked corn on the cob, 8 tablespoons butter, 1/2 cup chopped scallions, 1/2 cup chopped yellow pepper, 1/2 cup red pepper, 2 cups drained canned hominy, 1/2 cup fresh or frozen lima beans, 1/2 cup fresh or frozen field peas, and 1/4 cup of minced chives. Yummy. Other foods young Craig loved and shared with readers, sometimes several times, in the course of writing 20 books, he was not above borrowing from himself. Turkey soup, tomato soup, grits and cheddar cheese casserole, cornbread, buttermilk, no sugar, hamburgers topped with Worcestershire, parsley, and lemon juice, chili with cubed or ground meat. One of his lesser known achievements later in life was to put buffalo chicken wings in the U.S. culinary map. Like Beard, Craig is blessed with a mother who has to prepare food for company every day. His youthful palate comes to know and enjoy various parts of the pig, greens, black-eyed peas, and I quote, incredible fried chicken and the best, richest pecan pie in the world. Enthusiastic little critic, though his callowness shows in the final two favorites. Canned white asparagus with hot tangy cheddar cheese sauce and 3-layer salad, lime gelatin, cream cheese and gelatin, firm tomato aspic. He would include in Southern cooking okra soup, doves and wild turkey for the hunters, and chicken. These chicken recipes run one after the other in the book. Honey fried chicken, chicken gumbo, chicken and sausage gumbo, Brunswick stew, burgoo, smothered chicken and variations, country captain, and chicken a la king. Sounds like the Yankees lineup, huh? The Yankees, oh, that was a mistake. The Mets. In the late 30s, Craig goes to college, briefly at Mississippi State and the University of Missouri, where he majored in journalism without any real commitment to the subject. He entered the Navy in 1942 as an enlisted man, became an officer, and ate his first foreign food, couscous, in Casablanca. Post-war, he came to Chicago. By now, I'm sure you all realize Chicago is the real sub-theme of this conference. And worked in public relations with so little gratification that he went back into the Navy during the Korean War. In 1953, he rolled the dice and applied to École Hôtelière de la Société Suisse des Hôteliers. If asked to state my goal, he wrote later, it seems to me that once more I had gone to that school solely by instinct with nothing other than a vague pattern in mind. I had applied for admission motivated by the desire to improve the quality of my life with little serious thought that it would lead to a solid career. God knows, I had no thought of becoming a chef, much less a head waiter. I was free. I had no family to support or account to. I wanted to learn about French cuisine and European wines. The fact that I had an opportunity to study table service was simply a bonus. It had not been part of my plans when I applied for admission, but I found myself equally at home wearing a waiter's uniform as I did wearing a cook's apron. I was inordinately proud, incredibly gratified in my role as a waiter. In either role, I found myself in a mild state of euphoria as I made new and grand discoveries every day. I had found my destiny, though I didn't know it at the time. He returned to New York, not Chicago, but New York. In 1955, Anne Saran of Gourmet Magazine commissioned 2 freelance pieces from him, one on tea, the other on vodka, and helped him to join the staff as a receptionist. It was a disaster. Much work, no money. When Saran opens a PR firm, he goes along. As part of the PR network, he learns that Jane Nickerson is leaving her post as the New York Times food editor. What follows will be very familiar to any of you who are familiar with the wonderful How to Succeed in Business. Turner Catledge was managing editor of the Daily Newspaper. Dernier Catledge was a good old boy from Mississippi, a slow-talking, genial, smiling man with 1,000 southern anecdotes. I must say it had taken me years to try to talk like a Yankee, but in the presence of Turner, I slowed my speech and slurred it more than I normally do. I had learned that Turner had attended Mississippi State College, as I had. One of the first questions he asked me is where I'd gone to school. Mississippi State, I said. Not Mississippi State. Mississippi State. That was more like it. Where did you live, son? Polecat Alley, I said, speaking the name of an old rundown section of the quadrangle, the dormitory where many students were housed. So did I, he said with enthusiasm, giving me a hearty smile. I gave him a brief rundown of my career, and we shook hands. Craig then goes on to his second interview, then returns to the managing editor. Catledge greeted me again, and we both stood. I like you, son, he said. I think you may work out fine. And it did. For once, opportunity had met superb preparation. Both Craig and the Times were lucky. Again, he writes, when I became food editor of the New York Times on September 9, 1957, I had small acquaintance with the first-rate restaurants of New York, let alone those of Europe and elsewhere. The simple and obvious fact was that I had never possessed enough money to dine in the style to which I might have liked to become accustomed. At that time, I could have pretty well summed up on one hand the good restaurants with which I had some conversance. They would have included Trader Vic's and the Blue Fox in San Francisco, Jacques' restaurant in the Cape Cod Room and the Drake Hotel in Chicago. I dined not often at the Colony 21 and Voisin in New York. But I knew my professional standards were beyond dispute. I had not waited banquets in Lausanne's Palace Hotel and the Beau Rivage for nothing. Because my training in at the hotel school, there wasn't a poorly made sauce that could be pawned off on me. I was a till-the-death defender of the faith of classic French cooking. I knew the names of the repertoire de la cuisine from Americaine to Andalouse and Anglaise through Viennoise. My connoisseurship of wines might leave something to be desired, but it could not be traduced by an uppity waiter or captain or maitre d'hotel or a second-rate chef de cuisine. After joining the Times, I did not suddenly become what might be called an avid restaurant goer. I did, however, dine routinely at some of the best-known restaurants in Manhattan. Inevitably, when a new restaurant would open, I would visit it twice or more to make reports of its quality. The two most important restaurants to be reviewed in my first years of serious restaurant criticism were La Caravelle in November 1960 and Lutèce in March 1961. Stars were not yet awarded. The first restaurant column to run on a weekly basis appeared in May 24, 1963. It included capsule reviews, about 100 words each, of four restaurants. None of these, he wrote later, to my knowledge, is still in existence. He did. Craig brought knowledge and energy and style to a time-supported determination to pay his own way. He ate and came back and ate again. As much as possible, he remained anonymous. It was revolutionary. I've often been asked, he wrote, how a young person could go about becoming a restaurant critic, and the answer is not easy. Basically involves two things. The ability to write and conversance with food. I've also been asked a related question. If you were to go back and reshape your professional life, how would you alter it? In the first place, I believe that the ability to write well and that taste, as it applies to dining, are instinctive. I think you are born with taste with a seed for making a sentence that reads well as one for learning to be discriminating where food is concerned. I graduated with a degree in journalism from the University of Missouri, but I did not learn to write at that school, nor was whatever small talent I had for writing nurtured at the school. I am simply of the opinion you cannot be taught to write. You have to spend a lifetime in love with words. The only two tools you need are the best encyclopedia and dictionary that your purse can afford. After that, you're on your own. Interestingly, he goes on to write, I have never considered myself a journalist in the genuinely basic and most romantic sense of the word. I've never chased an ambulance or covered a fire. I've never been in police court, never ridden a paddy wagon, never interviewed a politician or written about hurricanes, holocausts, or havoc in the streets. My beat has simply been the world of restaurants and dining. It goes on, I'm trying to just edit a little bit here, save us some time. And two, there were those in terminal years as a restaurant critic when I did write about the opening of Four Seasons and Lutèce and La Caravelle, and there were those endless visits to the restaurants of Europe. But there wasn't a great deal of panic about getting there first. Revolutions and heart-stopping moments in the world of food and restaurant criticism are hard to come by. Come to think of it, I can recall only one momentous get-it-in-print-as-soon-as-possible moment, the day that Jacqueline Kennedy selected a Frenchman to be chef at the White House. Even today, that sounds a little trivial and tame by journalistic standards. Equally important was Craig's work as food editor. In reality, he was a food writer or columnist. He never edited. In fact, he never corrected a book galley. It was a curious superstition. He had a nose for news and alerted readers to trends such as low-salt diets, nouvelle cuisine, and new American cooking. He also found talent, both professional and amateur. Here is a partial list of his subjects: Madher Jaffrey, Marcella Hazan, Mady Heater, Ed Joby, Diana Kennedy, Penelope Cassas, Paul Prudhomme, Edna Lewis, Bill Neal, Stephen Piles, Dean Fearing, Paul Bocuse, Jean Toigrot, Alain Chappelle, Freddie Giraudet. Among the amateurs, one of my favorites is a friend of mine, a woman named Liz Rich, who was a stewardess for TWA, and she was flying Paris, New York. So under an assumed name, she wrote Craig a letter and said, I have this friend who does this wonderful life, and she shops in Paris and cooks in New York. Well, sure enough, Craig called up, came over, talked to her, wrote a story. And that's how easy it was in those days. In that sense, it was the best of times, but Craig often was depressed and self-depreciating. He also was caught up in an unrequited love affair with Pierre Fernet, the brilliant and handsome French chef who worked with Craig on a volunteer basis from the early 1960s. In his autobiography, he writes of a home dinner with Pierre and Pierre's wife, Betty. That was the beginning of a relationship without which my life would have been impoverished, a relationship that for more than 20 years has enriched the food pages of the New York Times. My debt to Pierre and the debt of the readers in my column to him are well beyond measure. Pierre, of course, died in 1996. He was taken ill aboard the QE2 and died as happily as possible. But Craig's coming out of the closet in that same book angered Pierre and really angered Betty. The two met, that's Craig and Pierre, and spoke only in business situations from then on. Craig retaliated by starting a long-run affair with a father of six children, but that's another story. But in 1963, he had Pierre's friendship in a new home in East Hampton, where he worked and played. You might call these the glory days. From the beginning, 271 Kings Point Road was a place of Saturday night revels. There was much, in truth, a golden age of gastronomy in my home that lasted until 1976. When Pierre joined the staff of the Times. After that date, we worked more normal hours cooking together during the week rather than on weekends. But the revels in the kitchen, on Long Island that is, often began as early as 5 in the afternoon with scotch and soda or a not too innocent potable. Our young bodies seemed immune to the perils of alcohol and we imbibed to the fullest. Typical menu during the glorious fun-filled years would be an hors d'oeuvre, followed by a soup, followed by a fish course, followed by a main course, followed by a salad with cheeses, followed by dessert, followed by coffee and cognac, or a stinger. The more serious part of the Saturday night ritual was that as Pierre and any visiting chef cooked, I stood at my typewriter and recorded exact ingredients and instructions for all the dishes we would dine on. These would subsequently appear in the New York Times Magazine. I note that on the 17th of December, 79, we dined on a cream of wild mushroom, a roast haunch of venison Saint-Hubert, puree of chestnuts, and endive meuniere. It was salad with brie, followed by orange sections marinated in Cointreau, and special cookies. On the 4th of May, with guests, the main courses included saddle of venison and sauce poivrade and civet of rabbit, plus noodles. There was salad, and for dessert, profiteroles filled with vanilla ice cream. The wines included Chateau Aubrion 71, Chateau de la Chaise 74, and non-vintage Krug champagne. We got a couple more here to help you get hungry. But to any There's a nice one at the end of this last menu. The wines included Beaujolais and Chablis plus Le Beer Rheingold. That is not to say that all the meals served in my home were elaborate French banquets. Far from it. There were entries for Chinese chrysanthemum pot, for pizza, hamburgers, chili con carne, for a cheese grits casserole. But, as Regis Philbin might say, let's get back to me. Earlier, I had gone to France and spent an intriguing year there, not learning French, but losing my English. At one point, Greg wrote and said he was going to be in town, but would I keep it quiet because he didn't want to go to the famous French restaurants. He wanted to have couscous. So we had couscous, and he asked me to take him to a couple of restaurants that I was frequenting away from the luxurious part of town. So I took him to my favorite place where I had never heard a word of English spoken, and no sooner had we sat down than a couple sits down next to us and begins talking about newspapers on Long Island, which interested Craig greatly. But there went my sense of being the all-knowing French guide. But the final thing that happened, as you probably read at some point, one of Craig at one point crowned the SS France as the finest restaurant in the world, and the finest floating restaurant in the world, and they were eternally grateful ever on. So when my time came to come back to the States, since I'd run out of money, I booked passage on steerage, essentially, on the France. And the first day out, I got an urgent message. I'd had to move my cabin, and that the purser was trying to find me. So I went up to the purser's office, and they started making this fuss. They want to put me in another room, and I was pretty exhausted. I'd been one of those typical farewells to Paris, so my head was bigger than the room. But I let them, you know, they talked me into going up and looking at this place, and when I walked in and there was a picture window opening overlooking the ocean, I suddenly realized it was exactly what I needed. So I allowed myself to be moved there, and yes, I said I would go to first class for dinner that night instead of steerage. And I got there, and I'm in the corner by myself. I really don't know what's happening. And suddenly this guy goes, psst, or as close to that as a French waiter can, and says, flashes me a picture. It's a picture of him serving Craig. And he says, we friends of Mr. Claiborne must stick together, no? And I said, oui. So for the next few days, I had total access to the kitchen, you know, the chef, anything I wanted the chef to make. I moved to a bigger table so I could order more food. Still bewildered by all this, I get to New York and only find out later that one, Craig had written them a letter and said a young friend of his was coming from France and would they give him one luncheon in first class. But the other thing that had happened was Time magazine had broken the story that Craig Claiborne was leaving the New York Times and his successor would be named soon. So the French added up one and one and got trois. And I spent the trip mostly worried how the hell I was going to tip all these people because I was broke. But anyway, I was obviously eternally grateful for that. I did pay a small price for it, by the way. But just as we were disembarking, the chef, who had been wonderful and lovely, said, would you take this to Mr. Claiborne? And he hands me a wrapped package. And I say, sure. Only later did I, as I'm strolling up and down the pier because my luggage is lost somewhere with my new best friend, the agriculture inspector, that he'd given me a packet of fresh Andouillette. And there's this puppy kind of walking around. I said, oh, my God, you know, I'm going to spend the rest of my life in jail. But the inspector was content just to describe all his great cases, and he didn't get it. So the Andouillette did get to Craig. Therefore, in fact, in 72, he did resign from the Times. In part, the cause was his inability to persuade the Times to hire Pierre. or even pay him for the efforts he was making. He writes, in addition, "It was also true the restaurant column of the Times had become for me an intolerable burden on several counts. The public concept of that assignment is that it would be one of the sweetest of pleasures to dine day after day, night after night, in the greatest restaurants in the greatest city in America, and all of it on an expense account. Not only that, but the added prerequisite of traveling around the world, feasting on glorious tidbits. The awful truth is that, to my mind at least, restaurant criticism under the best of circumstances is by no means all cake and ale, champagne, truffles, and caviar. I dislike the power. It burdened my conscience to know that the existence or demise of an establishment might depend on the praise or damnation to be found in the Times. Although I reasoned correctly that the judgment of a food critic did not invariably determine whether a restaurant would prosper or suffer moral decline. But my role as restaurant critic, Cassandra or no, weighed heavily on my soul. Many's the sleepless night I've lain in bed worried about the stellar worth of one restaurant or another, about whether I was justified in referring to a chef's Mornay sauce as pure mucilage, or whether the unaccounted flavor in the hollandaise was actually basil or rosemary as I had judged it to be. And to tell the truth, I was bored with restaurant criticism. At times I didn't give a damn if all the restaurants in Manhattan were shoved into the East River and perished. Had they all served Nightingale's tongue on toast and heavenly manna and mead, there's just so much the tongue can savor, so much the human body and spirit can accept, then it resists. Toward the end of my days as restaurant critic, I found myself increasingly indulging in drink, the better to endure another evening dining out. I had become a desperate man with a frustrating job to perform." In 1974, after the newsletter he and Pierre launched failed, he's back at the Times, and Pierre gets the 60-minute gourmet column, which in turn made him famous and rich. Chefs continued to make the pilgrimage to his new and larger East Hampton kitchen, but more did, in time, become less. There were great celebrations, a 50th birthday aboard the France, a 60th at home with everyone in the food world in attendance, a 70th in Monaco, organized by the great chefs of France, his last public hurrah. The most famous event, however, was a 1975 dinner he and Pierre shared at the Parisian restaurant Chez Denis. Craig, and this is funny because it's such a, he could be such a diffident man and shy, but he was ballsy. In this case, he had responded to a PBS offering to bid for a dinner in a restaurant anywhere in the world. And so for $300, he won this raffle. And looking various places, he went to Paris and then picked this particular restaurant, Chez Denis, partly because while it was well regarded by other critics, the Michelin Guide, for some reason, had banned it. So it was very appealing to him that this was a restaurant frowned on by the Michelin. So he explains that he, the owner, proposed a menu. It was all in clear outline, and the cost, 17,600 new francs, or the equivalent of $4,000. I did not gasp. I smiled, savoring the reaction of American Express when they got the bill. If it had been 6,000, I would not have been disturbed. This lark, I reflected, was turning out to be some bird. Was it worth it? It was grand. There was endless caviar and foie gras and truffles and orlatons, a superb dish made of hundreds of fillet of oysters, chicken oysters, a chauffeur de woodcock with Chambertin wine, oysters with white butter sauce, a parfait of truffled sweetbreads, Charlotte and Pears Alma and Floating Island, and dozens of other delectables. And the wines, of course, were the factor responsible for the cost. Chateau Latour, 1918, Chateau Mouton Rothschild, 1928, Romani Conti, 1929, Chateau Yquem, 1928, Madeira, 1835, Calvados, 1865, Champagne, Comtesse Marie de France, Cuvée Denis, 1966, Montrachet, Baron Thénard, 1969, Lafitte Rothschild, 1947, Petrus 61, and Cognac Bordage. He said he wasn't too hungry afterwards, but neither was he cowed. He goes on, when the article had been filed, I had no earthly idea how the Times would greet it. They might, I felt, ignore it as a fatuous caprice and relegate my copy to the wastebasket. I learned the next day that the dinner had been headlined on the front page, and it did, of course, make headlines around the world. I have a quick historical footnote on that. I was at the Washington Post at that point and had a call from someone in Paris tipping me off that this had happened, so I wrote a short piece for the Post. And the editor who generally handled these things was gone for the weekend, and the thing sat there for 3 days. What I wrote never was published, but if the Washington Post had reported about this dinner, the Times never would have put it on page one. But we didn't, and they did, and the subsequent reaction was considerable. As Craig writes, the dinner was not without its barbs. Subsequently, almost 1,000 letters arrived at the desk of the editors of the New York Times, half of them amused by the episode, the other half damning the vulgarity and cold-bloodedness and heartlessness of Pierre and me, dining in such luxury while half the world starves. We were put down by the Vatican as having committed a scandalous act. And all in all, some of the most cherished of my possessions is the vast accumulation of letters, pro and con, tear sheets from magazine and newspapers all over the world. And for the $4,000, Logic and several thousand readers asked if it was a perfect meal in all respects. The answer is no. The crystal was Baccarat and the silver was family sterling. But the presentation of the dishes, particularly the cold dishes such as the sweetbread parfait and quail mousse tart, was mundane. The foods were elegant to look at, but overall display was undistinguished, if not to say shabby. The food itself was generally exemplary, although there were regrettable lapses there too. The oysters in the shells, which should have been piping hot, were almost lukewarm when they reached the table. And so was the chartreuse of pheasant. The lobster in gratin was chewy, and even the sauce could not compensate for that. The chef of Chez Denis, being French, on hearing these criticisms, shrugs his shoulders and says, there were other customers to be served that evening. through all this, it should be understood, Craig was far from perfect. His moodiness and public drinking increased. His health declined. He was not a scholar. His instincts were those of his métier, do the best you can within the constraints of time and space. He did, however, find a way to write and present recipes, concise and lean, that didn't threaten readers. This was a real revelation. In the 80s, though, the readership and the editing team at the Times began to change. Americans were dining out instead of cooking in. The women's movement and the food industry attacked from scratch cooking as denigrating and a waste of time. Readers wanted shortcuts and convenience, not sweetbreads and charcuterie. The question no longer was how do I make it, but what's in it? He lost the Sunday Magazine column, then in 1986, he limped away. The last 15 years, he was intermittently active, increasingly cut off. Richard Olney describes being snubbed by Craig at a party. He gave the James Beard Foundation a slap in the face by refusing to appear in person to accept the Lifetime Achievement Award. He had a date to demonstrate knives for a knife company at the supermarket. My last sighting of Craig occurred a couple of years ago. I was crossing 57th Street in Manhattan, and Craig had an apartment there near 7th Avenue, and he was being pushed in a wheelchair by a nurse, and had just finished dinner, obviously. I leaned over and said hello and said who I was, and it was a sort of flash of recognition for a few seconds, and then he just went dull and had nothing more to say, and off they went. But increasingly, his last years were like that. His legacy, he gave opportunities for male journalists to become food editors. He helped establish the concept of independent restaurant critics. And there is, in Sunflower, Mississippi, a crossroads where Craig Avenue meets Claiborne Street. In years to come, The service food journalism he practiced may return. And from the CIA, where he left the balance of his estate, may produce another Craig Claiborne. In the interim, there is an astonishingly worthwhile new book which just came out this past year called The Best of Craig Claiborne, and it contains 1,000 recipes, and they're pretty good. Thanks.